It's the big one, the quarterback show. We're talking about Baker Mayfield and the new trends trickling up from the college game, what to expect from Jimmy Garoppolo and Deshaun Watson after they showed glimpses of greatness, and of course, we're unveiling the ranking of the top 10 quarterbacks in the NFL for 2018. It's all on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We have reached the finale of the position ranking series. This is the quarterback show. We are excited. We both rented tuxedos for the show, and it's going to be a very classy affair. We're even going to, as some of you have requested, we're going to dive a little bit deeper when we do the unveiling of the top 10 quarterbacks in football, our show's ranking. But yeah, Andy, we have reached a very interesting point in quarterback play in the NFL, and I think you have to be optimistic looking at the talent and looking at some of the creativity that is starting to seep into the league.
What's interesting to me is you have 10 young QBs just kind of entering the league, the six first round picks this year, and then last year's first round picks, and throw in Jimmy Garoppolo because he's new to the scene. So you have those 10 guys, but then the old guard, the Manning, Roethlisberger, Rivers, Brady, even Rodgers, he's almost 35, or he is 35 at this point, Breeze, these old guys are still at the highest of level. In fact, they're probably better now than they were 5 years ago, which tells you the position's changing, and we can get into that more as we go along, but there's a big age gap between starting quarterbacks in the league now.
There is, when Albert Breer filled in for you a couple of weeks ago when you were on vacation, we talked about quarterbacking quite a bit, and one thing we sort of discussed is when you look around the league, I don't know if you can really identify a team and say, wow, they are in dire need of a quality quarterback. You have to squint sometimes. You have to be optimistic about a guy like Ryan Tannehill or someone like that, but. Quarterback play is in the best shape it's been in a pretty long time here.
Well, it depends how you look. Are we comparing it to quarterback play of years past, or are we comparing it to quarterback play that's going on currently? It's all relative. If your quarterback is very good, but the other team's quarterback is great, what does that say? Where does that leave you with your quarterback? Even though these guys don't play head to head, and there's no right or wrong. That's just open for interpretation. The other thing I was thinking about, Gary, is last year that one of the narratives when we got to the end of January was look at these final four teams. It's Nick Foles versus Case Keenum in the NFC Championship, and it's Blake Bortles in the AFC Championship. Maybe we need to rethink what we expect of quarterbacks, and maybe you can build teams around these guys and have them be complementary players. The complicating factor, though, is Jacksonville did that, and they had probably the most talented defense in the NFL and a decent running game, so we've seen that work before. But those other two guys, Keenum and Foles, yeah, they're complementary QBs, but at that point last year, they were playing like superstars. They're not proven superstars, but that's how they were playing, which leads me to believe quarterback play still rules the day in pro football.
Yeah, well, let's start off by talking about sort of where the position is going a little bit. The Browns caught some people off guard. A lot of people looked at John Dorsey and said, oh, look at John Dorsey's history of drafting. He's going to take the big guy with a big arm. And he took the opposite of that. Not that Baker Mayfield doesn't have a good enough arm, but he is not a big guy. He is a spread college quarterback. I feel like as recently as maybe 5 or 6 years ago, he's a guy who you would have looked at the system he played in college and said, he's a developmental guy. He's a day two, maybe day three guy. Instead, he was the first overall pick of the draft. So with this sort of, the trickle-up effect and the rise of more spread concepts, and as we saw, not that there will be teams running RPOs the majority of the time, but obviously that has become a very, very big sort of side dish in the NFL world. Are we sort of seeing a sea change at this point with how teams evaluate quarterbacks and what they're looking for in young quarterbacks?
That's interesting timing, because the other day, I think it was yesterday, someone from the Browns staff called me out of the blue to just talk about these exact things. And the conversation, he wanted to talk about what the trend is in today's NFL. What did you see this offseason that you're studying? And we went over RPOs and how it's much more than just RPOs. The league is about, in my opinion, it's going in this direction of manipulating defenders through design. So we're going to leave someone unblocked and let the play design beat them. And that's what more offenses are doing. And you can do that with by running your QB where there's not a body to account for him, running read option off of that. RPOs are an obvious one. Jet sweep, those kind of things. It's a misdirection NFL now, and it really changes the way you evaluate quarterbacks and play with your quarterback in some cases. And the Browns will be an interesting case because of that exact reason. The rest of the conversation was just me humming and hawing through everything he was saying so then I could jump in and say, why are you guys playing Tyrod Taylor in practice now and not just going with Baker all the way? And that too is a philosophical quarterback discussion.
Yeah, we've talked a lot on this show about the potential redshirting or even if it's an abbreviated redshirting of Baker Mayfield, though I guess there's no such thing as an abbreviated redshirt because you either redshirt or you don't redshirt. But sort of slowing his development seems a little bit foolish, as we've talked about on this show. I don't know.
Well,
I mean,
the guy's answer for that, to be fair, because I agree with you, and I have softened on my opinion a little bit after hearing from the people that are actually making this decision. Because I said, well, you know more about Baker than Tyrod anyway. I'm sure you studied him before the draft a lot more than you studied Taylor before free agency / the trade that you made. And he said, well, that's just not true, because when we studied Taylor, it was NFL film that we've seen. So at least we know what he is as a pro QB. Baker, you don't know, and that becomes a guessing game to a certain degree. So I get that. They feel Tyrod gives them the best chance to win now because of what he's proven in the NFL. And it's easy for us, Gary, to sit here and say, well, you should take the long view on this, but these guys, these coaches, for one, they have to think about their jobs a little bit. They want to be around. They believe they can help the team in the long view, but they got to be there for the long view. You can't get fired in October and be the long-term head coach. So that's one of it. The other thing is they have the rest of the roster to deal with. And if you're not playing the QB that gives you the best chance to win right here in this game we're getting ready for, it's going to become hard to get ready for that game, and that carries over. So I understand the thinking of it, but if I'm a GM and I can't, if I'm John Dorsey and I'm brand new and I do have the luxury of taking the long view, I'd like to see Baker Mayfield getting all the reps. But it's not John Dorsey's decision right here and now.
Well, the other thing, the other reason, I don't know if this came up at all, that I thought they'd be sort of especially enamored with Tyrod Taylor is the turnover avoidance after a year where they had, 28 interceptions by their quarterbacks. It's probably not going to be as problematic for them to say, well, we're going to give up on some big plays here, but we're also not going to turn the ball over three times a game.
Well, and I see on our outline, our next question was you asking about that exactly. Nick Foles, ultra-conservative QBs, although he didn't play like that when he won the Super Bowl, but I know what you're asking. Alex Smith, Tyrod Taylor, Can you go with these guys? And the answer to that is it really depends on your system. Alex Smith in Kansas City, for example, who leaves throws on the field every week, and that's the other side of not throwing turnovers, not throwing interceptions, is you leave some mid-level completions, a 15-yard type completions, the timing and rhythm throws, they're not always attempted on schedule or at all. Can you live with that? Well, the look at the Chiefs offense and all the stuff they did with these misdirection things we just talked about. Tyreek Hill running jet sweep. They did read option. They built multiple options into different plays. Travis Kelce on fake shovel passes, actual shovel passes. They were such a highly schemed offense. Contrast that with the Browns last year, who didn't have as much experience at wide receiver or running back. Wide receiver was the big issue. They felt they had to simplify their scheme to adjust to those guys. In my opinion, they really oversimplified it because everything was spread sets like we're talking about, but it was not highly schemed. It was spread formations with four different receivers out wide running individual routes, and there was nothing to control the defense. You just had to out-execute them, and the Browns couldn't do that, and they threw a lot of interceptions with DeShone Kizer as a consequence. I can guarantee you this, Gary, if they're going to play that way this year, there's no point whatsoever going with Tyrod Taylor because he's not that kind of guy. You need the scheme with him. And he was successful when you get him outside the pocket and you're scheming with him. They did do that well in Buffalo. But he is not just a drop back and let it rip kind of QB, not even close to that. So a lot comes down, and my guess is the Browns will be scheming more, and that's part of the reason they went out and traded for Jarvis Landry, who would make a great fit in these misdirection type offenses.
Yeah, and look, they brought in Todd Haley too with the thought that he would bring some new ideas to that offense.
See. His reputation is not that around the league now, anyway. A lot of people in the NFL feel, well, Todd Haley had Antonio Brown, he had Le'Veon Bell, he just lined up and played and was very simple, and he won with better players, and he had Ben Roethlisberger, and I think there's some validity to that. So this is a whole new challenge for Tyrod. How about Tyrod Haley? We'll just call it the whole offensive group right there and merge them.
Some sort of, I don't know, we're having a wedding here for Todd Haley and Tyrod Taylor. Bringing up Nick Foles, he was a guy, and I view him as sort of the opposite of your Alex Smiths, of your Tyrod Taylors, when it came to the late season performance. And to me, it just sort of showed, I think overall in this league, we had this trend, and maybe it started back in the 90s. Anyone who follows football even casually has heard, team that wins the turnover battle wins more games and that sort of thing. And I think there was sort of an increasing emphasis put on avoiding turnovers and playing conservatively on offense. And what happened over the years is the league started basically literally with the rules of the league, it just gave these enormous advantages to the offense. And defenses started getting really conservative and saying, okay, we're going to make offenses, since we can't beat them, we're going to try to contain them. And offenses never really adjusted for the most part. And maybe we're seeing it now, but offenses still sort of said, well, we're going to make sure we don't turn the ball over. But then you see a guy like Nick Foles, who's a backup quarterback, a guy who we in early January last year thought was going to be the reason the Eagles didn't win a playoff game. He goes out. He sort of, it's the cliche I keep throwing out is put your foot on the defensive's neck and basically go out and be the aggressor and test the tight windows and basically force the defense to make plays if they're going to beat you. And it turned out, he hangs a 1,000 points on the Vikings and then 10,000 on the Patriots in the Super Bowl. And I think anyone watching that has to kind of say, oh, maybe we should recalibrate our risk-reward calculation with this. And I think you see that with the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes. I think Patrick Mahomes is a guy who might throw 15 interceptions this year, but they have a chance to just put up an obscene amount of points with him and with the guys around him.
Put their foot on their throats. Is that what you said, or was it on their neck? You said put their
throat.
Foot.
I remember, did I say throat or neck?
Well, I remember in the early 2000s when John Kitna was quarterback in the Lions, and Kitna had this reputation. He was a very overt Christian, a very soft-spoken guy, a serene leader. And they were talking about that on the Fox telecast, and then they went to one of his mic'd-up things right there in the game, and he was screaming at his teammates on the field, stomp on their necks, stomp on their necks, talking about putting the nail in the coffin on the defense. That's just a horrible image when you slow it down. Think of stomp on their necks. Stomp on their throats, I think, is actually what he was saying. Anyway, Nick Foles became a throat stomper last year, and that's why I think it's hard to have a Nick Foles conversation, because we don't know what he is exactly. Is he the Nick Foles we've seen forever, or is he the Nick Foles that all of a sudden played like Carson Wentz for the most important three-game stretch of his life? And what do you do about that when all of a sudden a QB who's been something for so long is not that anymore, and he's something else, and it's in a good way for them? I mean, it happens in a bad way too, but what do you do with that, and how do you tolerate it? And you bringing up Mahomes was a great example, Gary, because the Chiefs know exactly what they have in Alex Smith. It has worked well, but not perfectly, and that's why they get to the divisional round or no further every year. And now they're really rolling the dice with the opposite style of QB in Mahomes. He is the antithesis of at least that's what they're expecting him to be, of a dink and dunk. He is not that. He's a gunslinger, just like Andy Reid had with Brett Favre in Green Bay, and that's the last time Reid had someone like that. So the Chiefs, who had the best game-managing QB, and do not take offense. That's exactly what Alex Smith is. I mean, we're not going to sit here and debate that. They had the best game management, the most classic game-managing QB in the league. They've gone out and decided we want a gunslinger now. I think that's pretty revealing what teams expect from their quarterback, at least certainly what the Chiefs do expect.
Well, let me and I want to back up slightly in our conversation here when you mentioned sort of misdirection is becoming the new trend across the league. And I just wanted to ask you very, very general terms. And this is how I always looked at it in kind of a very simplified way. You can either use misdirection, and I think the more you use misdirection, the defenses see it more and more, that misdirection becomes less effective. Not necessarily ineffective and something you have to throw away, but the more you see it, the more you adjust to it and you're able to defend it. As opposed to let's call it exploiting the space. The defense has 11 defenders, and if you can put them in a situation where they just can't defend all the space, whether it's Tom Brady picking a team apart, and obviously everyone would take Tom Brady if they could have Tom Brady. Is the misdirection aspect, is that a long-term approach? I mean, is that something you can say, we're going to do this for 5, 6, 7 years, or is this kind of like, we'll do this for a year, maybe 2 years, and then we'll go back to the drawing board, and it'll be a constant evolution with what we do?
You have to be able to win without misdirection in the NFL. Now, if misdirection's your identity, that's fine, but you need to have answers and the capability of moving the chains on third down and long, and misdirection's not going to do. Misdirection's a first and second down tactic because the run threat is often a big part of it. And the reason misdirection, you're right, it does. It becomes easier to figure out as the season progresses. A reason for that is because teams are not running innovative, complex stuff off of the misdirection. The misdirection's an illusion and a presentation, but the plays themselves, when you get to the end of the play and what did we actually do strategically there, they're often very traditional, classic plays, very simple plays. So, and that's why teams are able to build in the misdirection. You don't have time to practice everything. You can't practice all this misdirection and reformationing and then have a complex playbook as well. One of those things has to be simple. And so misdirection for that reason cannot be your only thing. That's why pocket passers still rule the day in the NFL. It always comes back to that. We do a lot of neat things with these running QBs, but at the end of it, it's Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, and it's Nick Foles, who was playing like a big-time pocket passer at the time. It's Nick Foles in the Super Bowl, and we see that again and again, and we're probably about ready to get into our top 10. We're going to see a lot of pocket guys in this list.
We are. We have three guys left to discuss, I think, in this opening segment. The two guys, small sample sizes, but I think there's more excitement around Deshaun Watson and Jimmy Garoppolo than anyone in the NFL. Garoppolo's made 7 starts, and before he got hurt, Watson had played basically, 6.5 games, and the first game and a half was running in offense that wasn't really built for him. So, it's almost like he played basically 5 games. Let's take him one at a time. I mean, what do you expect, based on what you've seen out of, let's start with Garoppolo.
Garoppolo, quick twitch, release, excellent footwork. Everything is compact and efficient. And both of these guys, Gary, we'll talk about how Watson does it. It's not going to be a surprise. But with Garoppolo, it's a lot of that illusion before the snap. Shanahan with all the pre-snap shifting and motioning that they do, that's not misdirection, but it's a cousin of misdirection, because we're talking about the way you present your plays. And once the ball snaps, Shanahan's offense is very simple, and Shanahan takes a lot of pride in that. That's why Garoppolo was able to step in. He didn't know what he was doing last year. There was no way you could have learned that whole scheme during the season in a matter of weeks, but he was able to step on the field and play right away anyway, because once the ball was snapped, the concepts were very simple and familiar. That's what they do well, but Garoppolo has that ability to beat you quickly from the pocket. That's why those simple concepts can still work. Do you want to tee up Watson, or can we just roll right into him?
Let's roll right into him.
Well, Watson has that ability to play from the pocket as well, and that's what we didn't know if he could or not, because he doesn't have a huge arm, and he wasn't pressed a whole lot in terms of being challenged that way at Clemson. But Bill O'Brien did a tremendous job of rewriting their offense to make it more misdirection, which also got Watson playing on the move a little bit, and that tapped into Watson's comfort zone. And then from his comfort zone, he was able to be a very aggressive QB. And what they love most about him in Houston is, yeah, you can do a lot of stuff schematically because of his legs, but he is willing to turn it loose downfield. In fact, he's too willing. He needs to dial it back or he'll have 20 or 22 interceptions this season. But you like the gutsiness. You like the decisiveness that he throws the ball with vertically downfield, deep dig routes. He was a very aggressive QB, and I'm going to be interested to watch these two. I think Watson will have more extremes this season. I think he's going to have some great highs, and he'll probably have some lows because of his nature and his style of play.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add on Watson. You know, when I mentioned the risk reward thing a little bit earlier, I mean this is kind of it. This is a guy who really, you know, he tries some throws that are throws that he probably shouldn't try, and you know, sometimes they have ended up in big plays. Sometimes, you know, he threw some really ugly interceptions last year, but certainly the good far outweighed the bad with him.
Watson story real quick. Tell your Deshaun Watson story.
Oh, what I wrote about him last year?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it had been, I think we actually discussed it on the show when it happened, before the Patriots game. He was coming off, so he had played the second half against the Jaguars, he had played the Bengals on Thursday night, and it was bad football. It wasn't working, and I thought he was a guy. I didn't think the Texans would ever really change what they do offensively. After seeing him for a game and a half, look, Tom Savage, this wasn't an over investment in the quarterback position. It wasn't going to be Tom Savage and Deshaun Watson battling for a couple years. I figured if they were going to change, we would have seen something. Not that Tom Savage is going to run what Deshaun Watson was going to run, but you would have seen some changes going into that first game, and you just didn't. So I sort of wrote, like, you know, this is I didn't sort of write this. I literally wrote this. I said, you know, this is dumb to throw to Sean Watson out there, asking him to run this, you know, this Bill O'Brien offense with all the isolation option routes, and expect him to be able to do this coming out of Clemson, which was a completely different system. And he went out. They changed up what they did. They had the extra 3 days. They changed up what they did when they went to New England. He had that just unbelievable performance where he completely torched the Patriots. Patriots offense. Brady had to do a superhero thing to come back and win that game, but it was a superstar performance, and the game ended, and like 3 hours later, I got a notification tweet from Deshaun Watson saying, I can't even remember exactly what he said, but
I remember what he said. He said, I laugh at people like you.
Yes, he did. And so I wrote back, I was like, because I'm funny? I didn't. No, he tweeted it, so I got the notification, then he deleted it. Saved it.
Do you think that's a strategy? Was that his mission all along?
Yeah, I asked the social guys. I asked Kevin Driscoll at SI, our social media guy. I was like, is that something people do? And he was like, yeah.
Oh, so, that's kind of clever and cowardly at the same time.
Little did he know, I have two phones. So I had checked on one phone, and then I was like, oh, it disappeared. Well, I'll screenshot the push notification on this phone.
And now you hang that screenshot somewhere in your office, I assume.
I do. I think I have a text from one of my friends, I don't know, saying something stupid about, I don't know, dogs or something. I have no idea.
The reason Watson works is because of how he plays from the pocket. All this stuff he does, and this is the difference between Kaepernick and Watson, because Kaepernick's a more talented entity than Watson. He's got a bigger arm. He's a longer stride. They're both long striding runners. Kaepernick's a little bit longer striding. My guess is he's a little twitchier and more explosive when he's physically at his best. But Watson's more effective with all of it. And the reason why is Watson can get grounded back into the pocket and play on schedule from there and force the defense to play with full integrity. Watson's QB coach, Sean Ryan, he calls it having quiet mechanics. You want to move subtly within the pocket. Mm-hmm. You don't want any herky jerky stuff. You don't want to cover a lot of ground when you move. It's a, most times people shouldn't even be noticing that you're moving in the pocket. And that's something that Watson got better at every week, which is why I am bullish on him. In fact, I haven't seen a guy improve his pocket mechanics so obviously and so soundly from week to week, at the, especially at the very beginning of his career. And that's what Kaepernick never developed, which is why coaches don't always feel they can run their system with him. Watson has developed it better than anyone I've seen so far. And he's got a ways to go still, but he is really off to a great start there.
Yeah, and I'll just say, look, I kind of oversee most of our draft coverage at the MMQB, and this is back when Emily Kaplan was still with us and doing a lot of draft stuff, and we did a lot of stuff on Deshaun Watson in the lead up to 2017. And I know a lot of people were upset when he was the third quarterback off the board in 2017. He was still a top 12 pick. There were some implications that, teams think he can't learn an NFL offense or something like that. That was, from the people we spoke to, that couldn't have been further from the truth. I mean, people were, I think he might have gotten some votes from some scouts and evaluators from NFL teams in the 2016 presidential election. I mean, he is a very bright guy. He is a true face of the franchise guy who you feel completely comfortable making basically the, if you go with a CEO cliche that a quarterback has to be for your franchise, that's Deshaun Watson. What scared teams off was the interceptions. He threw a lot of them at Clemson, and some of them were ugly and sort of head-scratching. And I think teams were a little bit worried if he was going to run around and extend plays. He's not, he's not built like Cam Newton. He's not built like Ben Roethlisberger. Is he going to get hurt? And obviously he, whether last year's ACL tear was a cumulative thing from some of the hits he took in the Seattle game, or whether it was just a freak accident in a practice, he did get hurt. So that was
a freak accident. Yeah, don't you think that's got to be I would imagine. I'm not a doctor. That's a freak accident,
there,
I would think.
I don't know either. I heard some conjecture that it might have basically been hanging by a thread after a certain day. He had, I think it ended up in a touchdown, something near the goal line where he spun and got hit, and you could tell something happened during it, and he was limping later. That's all guesswork.
It's like the Carson Wentz ACL play there, what you're describing. A lot of ACL plays this year. These guys are healthy now, at least.
Well, you get near the goal line, you want to get in there. It was a neat play, kind of like Carson Wentz's touchdown. But he's back, and we'll see what they have in store here in 2018. Last guy I wanted to talk about was Russell Wilson, who is a guy we've discussed plenty on the show, and obviously he'll be in the top 10 countdown here. But we'll jump on him now. Andy wrote about this last December, and then the Barstool guy responded, and he had swears in capital letters in his, so he was probably right, because whoever is loudest and most profane is usually right. But Russell Wilson, I think he's as good as there is out of structure, and we've seen. I'm thinking back to second half of 2015, starting with that Steelers game when they sort of did the spread quick strike thing. They started doing that, and I think you were in the same boat as me, thinking this was the start of something incredible with Russell Wilson, and this guy was going to be an MVP front runner in coming seasons if they could maintain this. And they moved away from it, and I've heard some people say they moved away from it because basically they showed it and teams weren't ready for it when they first brought it out, and then teams were ready for it the next year and they just couldn't do it as effectively. But I don't know what the solution with Russell Wilson is at this point, besides let him do the out of structure stuff. And you get some duds, but you also get maybe not quite an MVP caliber performance, but you get certainly a superstar like quarterback.
Well, a few things there. So they went to that they still do the spread stuff. They went to empty formations, I think, more than every team in the league last year. If they remember, J.D. McKissic would come in and rotate out or shift out to wide receiver. They were often in empty when they did that. And that's a staple of what they do. Offenses ultimately take on the shape of their quarterback. I learned this with Cam Newton last year, where we thought they're going to try to do exactly what we're describing, these quick strikes, spread empty stuff, get McCaffrey, get Curtis Samuel out there, and let's beat teams early in the down. And that's not Newton's style of play. He's a late in the down player, and ultimately you're going to be whatever your quarterback is. Same thing with the Green Bay Packers. They're not a schemed offense. They're a isolation offense, because that fits Aaron Rodgers' style of play. Well, Russell Wilson's not a quick timing player at all. He's the best out-of-pocket sandlot guy I've probably ever seen. And that's what he's played his whole life, and that's what they become, even in empty formations at times. The issue with him, and the reason he's gotten so good out of the pocket, is he doesn't always see well within the pocket. He's 5'10 and 3/4. Everyone likes to add that 3/4 in there. He's almost 5'11", and there are throws that you cannot – it's not an opinion. It's not a hot take. It's just we're talking science. There are throws you cannot see when you are that short from the pocket. So you have to compensate. And his way to compensate, because he's so mobile, is to get outside the pocket. And when it works, it's brilliant. The problem is it's hard to build a consistent offense around something like that. Everybody else has to practice for you being outside the pocket. So your pass blockers, who are used to blocking with a stationary QB, that's how they've played their whole life. Now they're blocking for a QB where they don't know where he is, which makes it almost impossible to block at times. Your receivers have to now run two routes per play. Seattle, the way they draw their plays up is there's a solid line version of the route, which is how the play is designed, and then they install a dotted line version of the route. Nate Carroll, Pete's son, he thought of this, and that's the route they're supposed to run when things break down. So they're doing twice as many things mentally on every play, and you're hoping everybody does everything the same way. They're all on the same page, which is hard to do. It's hard to get 11 guys all on the same page when the page is always turning. And the consequence is Seattle's great on some weeks, and then other weeks we see them like we did down the stretch last year, where the Rams held them to 149 yards of offense in week 15. And the next week, Dallas held them to 136. And earlier in the year, there were several games that they didn't even approach 250. It's a week-to-week offense, and I don't think that's going to do it. I don't think that's enough to do in the NFL. So when they have a running game that can stabilize things, they're fine in Seattle. But if they're relying on Russell Wilson in this week-to-week passing game, they're going to be a 10-6 playoff fringe team every year.
Yeah, they were. Not to use the Andy's column on Russell Wilson as the line of demarcation, but they were quite bad offensively down the stretch after that happened. The one other thing I just wanted to bring up with Wilson, and obviously when you are under 6 feet, there are going to be limitations for what you can do from the pocket. There's also, when you're under 6 feet, biomechanically, I think he's able to do things outside the pocket when he's on the run. There are things he can do athletically that a 6'4" guy, you know, there's just so much going on. There's so much length. There are so many things that can go wrong mechanically when you are a taller, lankier guy that Russell Wilson doesn't have to worry about. I think you'd rather be able to be 6'4" and do those things from the pocket, but I think there's a certain advantage to being undersized and being sort of built like the he almost has like a running back build, Russell Wilson, you know, when it comes to moving around, and therefore he can do things on the move that just are biomechanically not possible for taller quarterbacks.
And that's what makes Aaron Rodgers so special, because he's not a tall quarterback, Rodgers. He's actually only 6'2". My guess is he's probably a tall 6'2", because he plays tall. He plays upright. But Rodgers can do what Wilson does with a bigger body, which is why he's so special, why he's going to be higher on the list than Russell Wilson. But Wilson, it goes back to the compactness. He's a compact player. Everything's tight to his body. His throwing motion is not super compact, which is fascinating to me, but it still comes out on the same schedule as the compact guys. So mechanically, he's a little bit different, but instead of just wading through all the details, let's just agree on this. He's the best thrower of the football out of the pocket on the move that I think I've ever seen. He's certainly, it might be Rodgers, might be, Rodgers probably has him beat by a margin, but as a touch passer, I've never seen anyone as good as Russell Wilson.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd go Rodgers one, and I'd go Wilson two in that. I just remember my favorite Russell Wilson play ever was it was a sack he avoided in that. Remember that below zero Vikings playoff game they had a couple years ago. While the Blair Walsh missed field goal at the end, but Everson Griffin was on Wilson's back on a second and long. Wilson had scrambled a little bit looking for someone open. Griffin's on his back, and it was going to take them out of field goal range, and Russell basically, I mean, he somehow got the ball off and ended up flinging it like 20 yards downfield, out of bounds to avoid the sack. But he is just, you know, you go all the way back to when people said, oh, Johnny Manziel. Well, Johnny Manziel is small, but he's, you know, so is Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson is powerful. I mean, he is a really strong guy, and he can do things that, you know, a Johnny Manziel, who's really not built the same way, Russell Wilson can do things that Manziel can't, or your typical, right, you know, 6 foot, let's say Case Keenum-y type of build guy can't do.
Well, and vision on the move is a big deal. Manziel was actually decent at that at times, which is why his team schemed to keep him in the pocket, because he was not good otherwise. He couldn't see out of the pocket either. Vision on the move. Mitchell Trubisky's not in this show. He might be one day, and if he is, we'll be talking about that trait with him. Some of these guys, it's the ability to see once they're moving, when their platform is changing. Brady, Brady, I don't know what his vision on the move is like, because he's never been on the move, but it's very different than vision from the pocket, and it's a whole separate skill set.
Yeah. Well, we're about to unveil the top 10 quarterbacks in the NFL, our ranking of them in just a moment. But first, just wanted to remind everyone, mailbag show coming up next week. So send those questions in. They can be about the position rankings. They can be about the upcoming season. They can be about literally anything. We answer really creative questions. Let's be nice and call them creative questions all the time. You can send them to talkback@themqb.com. Just put podcast in the subject line. You can send them to Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI, or you can send them on Facebook. We're both on Facebook, and we'll get them there. But big mailbag show next week. Right now, let's unveil our ranking of the top 10 quarterbacks in football. If you are joining us for the first time, which some of you might be since it is the quarterback show, we do this AP poll style. Andy, myself, and our researcher this week, it is Colin Bowers. We each submit our ranking of the top 15 players. If you get a first place vote, you get 15 points. Second place vote, 14 points. All the way down to 15th place vote gets 1 point. If you're joining us for the first time, Andy's vote counts double. We give Andy the double vote because he knows that much about football. But we'll get to it here. We had 19 guys get votes this week. We will start with the others receiving votes and then unveil the top 10. So if you're doing the math, this starts with number 11. That is Cam Newton, then Derek Carr, Jared Goff, Deshaun Watson, Jimmy Garoppolo, Eli Manning, Jameis Winston, Dak Prescott, and Kirk Cousins. I wanted to bring up two names here. One of them is Derek Carr. What do you make of Derek Carr at this point, Andy? Because I thought he was in for a breakout season last year, and it was quite the opposite.
It was. The Raiders really didn't have a great offense around him, though. Their wide receivers played poorly. Their running game was a week-to-week proposition. Their O-line was never as good as people thought it was, and that got exposed when the other guys started playing poorly. And their coordinator had a transition period. We'll put it that way. Todd Downing, he wasn't as experienced as Bill Musgrave, and it showed at times, I think. And Carr bared the brunt of that, and Carr didn't do enough to overcome it. Some guys maybe would. Most guys absolutely would not. And that's where he is. I like the skill set of Carr. There's another guy with compact mechanics. He's what he is. And when the other two guys who are like this, and they're going to be on our top 10 list, is Matthew Stafford and Aaron Rodgers. Carr can flick the ball with his wrist. He can throw with only wrist. He doesn't necessarily need his full arm motion to make plays. And that gives you a lot of answers in empty sets where it's quick strike stuff, and it gives you more answers when you're playing on the move. And Stafford and Rodgers, they're two other excellent on-the-move throwers. It's the ability to flick the wrist and flick the ball out of your wrist. Carr is as good as anyone. He's as good as those other two guys almost in that department.
And Dak Prescott, you know, we talked about him late last year, and you had sort of said, you know, he wasn't I think a lot of people saw it as a sophomore slump, as a disappointing year. You didn't think he had really slid back. You thought it was more a matter of he had ideal circumstances as a rookie, and he didn't have those in year two. And now as we look forward to year three, you know, whatever you think of Dez Bryant, 2 years ago, Dez Bryant was a guy who would draw double teams. There's really no one in that receiving core who would do that. And then on top of that, you know, Jason Witten, your security blanket is gone. So, I mean, is this just getting worse and worse for Dak Prescott?
Dallas is going to be built off of their running game because of their O-line and because of Elliott, and then because Prescott's style of play is most conducive, in my opinion, he's best as a point guard in a run-oriented offense. So get him on rollouts, do some read option stuff with him, play action where the play develops a little bit slower. Let him read the field and be a ball distributor rather than a gunslinging, timing and rhythm, aggressive downfield thrower. So all of their passing concepts, they're not all of them because you can't do it on third and long, but their core passing foundation needs to derive from their running game, and I think that's what best suits Prescott. Last year, the running game was not what it was the year before for a variety of reasons, and Prescott's inconsistency was reflective of that.
Yeah. Well, let's unveil the top 10 here, and this worked out kind of nicely. If you're going to break things into tiers, we did have a gap between the top 10 and Cam Newton at 11 here, and we have a couple nice gaps here. So I'm going to sort of present these in tiers, and yes, they are. I'll give them like a 10, 9, 8, 7, 6 ranking, but I'll unveil 6 through 10 here. But as far as our voting went and the points gathered by each guy, you can basically shuffle these guys however you want. So please don't go nuts that this guy was 6 and this guy was 10 and whatever. So number 10 is Andrew Luck. Number 9, Matthew Stafford. Number 8, Russell Wilson. Number 7, Philip Rivers. Number 6, Matt Ryan. Let's go one by one here. Luck, obviously, I mean, look, it's a lot of unknowns at this point. We haven't seen him throw a football since January 2017. Based on what they're doing, they built up the interior of that offensive line. They're obviously they made it a point to try and protect him better. And that sort of seems to mean that they're not going to go to quick strike. They're going to sort of let Luck play as he has played in the past. How nervous does this make you, Andy? Or is this just sort of is taking that away from Andrew Luck if they did that, if they made this just a pure quick strike offense? Do you sort of lose what makes Luck special?
Right. Right, that's the Cam Newton debate, is how much should we run him in Carolina? And my whole thing is, well, if you're not running Newton, the reason to not run him is you want to preserve him and protect him. But if you're not running him, he's not the same quarterback. Is he even worth preserving and protecting the same way then? And that's with Luck. He is a late-in-the-down pocket passer. It's not many guys are that combination. Most of them are late-in-the-down, out-of-pocket passers, like Russell Wilson. Luck can extend plays within the pocket, which makes your play designs last longer. The play does not break down. It just extends. It just goes longer, and it becomes nearly impossible to defend. The consequence is you take a lot of big hits when you play that way and hang in the pocket that long, and we've seen that with Luck, and early in his career he was incredible at enduring them and just getting up and continuing to play, and now here he is later, or at least let's hope the midpoint of his career, and he's had all the shoulder issues, and I don't think he can take those hits anymore. So I think they do need to adjust the offense, and I don't know if they are. By taking those guards, it suggests to me that they will not, that they will just let Luck play his style. Remember, your offense usually just takes the shape of your quarterback anyway, so Luck would have to make some drastic adjustments. But a guy who did is the guy that Frank Reich, their new head coach there in Indianapolis, It's the guy he coached last year in Philadelphia, Carson Wentz, who's found a nice balance between extending plays and running a quick strike scheme. So it's possible, and I think Wentz and Luck have very similar skill sets, but we're talking high-level superstar stuff now. Luck, Roethlisberger's done it as well, actually. That's the only other guy I've seen do it. Big, powerful pocket QB who can become a quick strike thrower. Luck needs to become Ben Roethlisberger now to preserve his career.
Yeah, let's talk Matthew Stafford here, number nine. I'll just ask you this about Stafford. I love Stafford's skill set. I think he's not only the arm strength and some of the throws he makes are throws that really no one else in the league can try for the most part. But he is much more athletic than he gets credit for, and he does make some plays with his legs. The thing that sort of gives me pause with Stafford, and again, I'm a Stafford believer. You kind of say, you look at their offense and say, well, you know, the team around him is not very good. They never had a great running game. They have a bunch of sort of number two / number three wide receivers there. But then you rewind a couple years and remember, well, he used to have Calvin Johnson, who, you know, is one of the top maybe 5 or 10 receivers to ever play. What do you make of that? I mean, is he, you know, I've heard some people say he's better as sort of the point guard, the distributor, and not having Calvin Johnson work. So it's almost like, okay, well, so if you brought in a true number one, would you even get that benefit with Matthew Stafford?
Well, think of Stafford this, because I don't see him as a point guard. Think of, for the basketball analogy, when he had Calvin Johnson, Stafford was the kind of, he'd be a basketball player who just shot a lot of contested threes. He's a gifted guy, but there was a mm-hmm. recklessness to him. There was not an intention. When Johnson left, they had to change the way they play, and Stafford became more of a drive-to-the-basket type of player, and he took more judicious shots. He was still equally as aggressive, ball still in his hand. He's still the one scoring. He's just not heaving up shots anymore. They're running more of there's a semblance of a system around him, and he's getting to the line, and there's an efficiency. That's his style of play. Jim Bob Cooter helped tap into that. Their offensive coordinator there in Detroit, who Matt Patricia has kept on. It's a make or break year for Bob Cooter, by the way. I do that every time, yeah. Don't I? I call him Bob Cooter,
Bob
the last
Cooter.
Name.
Yep.
Yeah, just Cooter. Jim Bob. It's a make or break year for Jim Bob. So that's Stafford. And when you don't have guys around you, it's hard to be a highly successful QB regardless, but running the system is going to be inherently inconsistent from week to week, especially if you can't run the ball very well. So I blame Detroit, and I don't think Stafford's flawless at all. He is at times, you still see the wild stallion side of him, not every snap like you could have years ago, but he is a little bit of an inconsistent QB by superstar QB standards, but he's got an even more inconsistent offense around him, and I think that's the biggest issue.
Number eight, Russell Wilson, who obviously we discussed at length a little bit earlier. I just wanted to throw one more hypothetical at you, Andy. It's not really a hypothetical. It's more of a team building question, which we talked about a lot. With Wilson, if you're going to lean on the out-of-structure stuff and sort of just settle for the fact that you might be a little inconsistent on offense, essentially, if you want to build up your run game, you can build up your run game for a lot cheaper than you would invest in building up your passing game. So you look at a guy like Wilson, what they were able to build around him, both on his side of the ball and on defense, when he was on that rookie contract and making like $18 an hour or whatever he got paid as a third round pick. Is there a wisdom to kind of saying, okay, well, we got Wilson, we don't need to surround him with elite offensive linemen because it's difficult to block for a guy who does improv so much anyway. We'll get ourselves a quality running back. We'll get ourselves some sort of more mauling offensive lineman as opposed to the super athletic, let's find our Walter Jones type of guy. And then you can invest in whatever, in your defense, in your wherever else you want to put the money.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that's a lot of philosophical assumptions and just question marks there. You could argue that
that's what I do.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot to unpack on that one because is it really cheaper to build your – you could argue that you need the line to have the running game. You need to have an enforcing, aggressive, domineering offensive line. You need the Dallas Cowboys, who have invested first-round pick after first-round pick in their line, and that's what you need more than the running back. You could argue that. The counter-argument would be Seattle itself, and although they have invested heavily along the O-line, it never has played up to that level. But years ago, Marshawn Lynch – compensated and was such a great player that they still were effective. So it's just, it's all perception on that. It's hard to answer.
It's also Wilson. Also, he obviously gives you some value in the run game as well. So
big time, huge time.
Throw that in there.
Well, because even if he's not running the ball, he's influencing defenders. You can have the read option type of stuff to really influence them, or you can just, after the QB hands off, especially in a zone scheme, which is what Dallas runs with Dak Prescott, and it's what the Seahawks have ran for a lot of years with Wilson because Marshawn Lynch likes this kind of scheme. On these outside zone running plays, the QB hands it off, and then the QB rolls out like he's still got the ball. When he does that, backside defenders have to stay home in case that QB really does still have the ball. And when there's no backside pursuit, life is a lot easier on your run game, especially your running back. So that is the value of having, and that's why your passing game needs to be built off your running game, because that helps your running game. Dak Prescott, when he rolls out without the ball, really helps Ezekiel Elliott because there's no backside defenders immediately crashing on Elliott. So yes, these mobile QBs are a major component of your ground game, and that's a very legitimate argument if you want to be in the camp that says Russell Wilson's top five. That's almost your starting point.
Number seven, Philip Rivers. It just overall, and I know it's kind of unfair to put everything that's happened and sort of boil it down into parsing the blame of the 18 wins over 3 years for this really talented Chargers team, but how much of it falls on Rivers? What has Rivers been in your mind the past couple of years? Because they've been ravaged by injuries. They've lost games in some of those bizarre manner over the last 2 years. And as much as I want to say like, oh, these are so many flukes, I guess it just reaches a point where it's like, this is too many flukes. These flukes must add up to something here. And how much does that have to do with Rivers himself?
I've wondered that, too. There's no way to know that without being on the inside of the building. But the Chargers have always, for a lot of years, route running mistakes with their receivers have led to an unusual number of turnovers. And that's probably been a third of Rivers' interceptions have derived from that. And the route running mistake, that's the fault of the receiver. But when it happens so many times again and again, at some point you have to say, why do the receivers keep making these mistakes? Is it a greater commentary on the offense as a whole, and who's the guy running the offense as a whole? And that gets back to Philip Rivers. So assigning blame's hard to do there. I don't know. Rivers play, we don't need to spend a ton of time on Rivers. The reason he's high on our list is he, within the NFL, he's probably even higher on people's list because he plays the position exactly as you like it to be taught and drawn up. And we're talking pre-snap phase with his adjustments at the line of scrimmage, post-snap and the way he makes reads and the way he throws with anticipation, and his arm is still plenty good enough. So Philip Rivers is the consummate professional quarterback.
And by the way, you should, if you haven't already, you should read Andy's piece, The Mind of Philip Rivers, explaining the game within the game. He broke down three plays with Rivers, two successful plays, one red zone interception. So really interesting stuff there if you like football, which I'm assuming you do if you've listened to an hour of the show. Number six, that is Matt Ryan. I guess the big question with Ryan is we saw him struggle year one under Kyle Shanahan. Year two, he's MVP. Steve Sarkisian came in, sort of tried to keep the same system in place. There were problems last year with this offense, and now year two, can we expect the problems to be cleaned up at least to an extent, even if we're not saying Matt Ryan's going to win MVP again?
Well, we can absolutely expect that because they've got the most talented offense maybe in the NFC. Certainly when they have both those running backs, Coleman and Freeman, on the field together, they're the most uniquely talented offense in the NFC. I guess I maybe backtrack that a tad with Kamara and Mark Ingram in New Orleans, but then you add in the Julio Jones factor. So Atlanta should be getting – what happened last year is they didn't get very many explosive plays, and that was the difference. And that's symptomatic of an offense that just wasn't quite clicking on all the cylinders like it was the year before. They just were not as pristinely refined, because explosive plays come most of the time out of designs working perfectly right on schedule. Ryan's a great illustration of what can happen when you put the right system around a guy, the right situation around a guy, and he plays the way it's supposed to be played. He plays the way you teach it, because his physical skill set is not top 10. It's good, not great. But he always plays a little more mobile than he should. He throws with a little more arm strength than he actually has because he anticipates well. And lately, the last 2 years, he's become a better decision maker. Remember, he used to, about once a week almost, just make a bonehead type of play, a head scratcher throw. He doesn't do that as much anymore. So Matt Ryan, and he was not great in year one under Dirk Cutter years ago, if I recall, and he was very good in year two under Cutter. So his history says he'll be better in year two under Sarkisian, the new coordinator. That's a big question, because if he is, I think Atlanta's the favorite in the NFC.
Yeah. Whoa,
Sorry. No, man. We have to finish the countdown. That's a preview show type of deal.
Yeah, I got to take a knee after that one, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I nailed you on that.
Let's go. If those guys were tier three, we'll call those five guys tier three. These guys are tier two. Two guys here. Number five, Ben Roethlisberger. Number four, Drew Brees. It's nice that Ben Roethlisberger is not threatening to retire this offseason, as far as we know. Todd Haley is out. We'll see. I mean, when I think about Derek Carr last year, Derek Carr, got Todd Downing, who he's close to, ended up being his offense coordinator, and I know a lot of people around the league kind of thought, well, does Derek Carr need someone to sort of kick him in the crotch a little bit more than his buddy did last season? Now, Ben Roethlisberger, obviously a more veteran guy here. He gets his quarterback's coach promoted. That's Randy Fichtner. Do you worry about the change at all? Do you worry about sort of the buddy quarterback offense coordinator type of thing? Since Roethlisberger is 36 years old, do you worry about him needing to be coached hard, or is this just going to be basically the same thing that we've seen for, I don't know, what, 5 or 6 years now?
Well, let me ask you, if Ben Roethlisberger didn't have that reputation with Bruce Arians from years ago, where they were too buddy-buddy and supposedly that's why Arians was let go in Pittsburgh, they wanted someone who would coach Roethlisberger harder, would you even ask that question?
Let's say yes.
You would ask it. Are we worried that
I look back at the Derek Carr thing. I worry about that now.
Yeah, but Carr is young. Carr's in his mid-20s. Roethlisberger's 36. I know. Are we worried about the coordinator and quarterback having too good of a relationship?
Yes. In short, yes.
Well, okay. My answer in short then would be no, where I'm not worried. Okay. I imagine that's a good thing.
I'm saying maybe it's not a good thing. Whatever. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Now I feel bad, Andy. I hope you're happy.
I'm sorry. I overreacted. But here's what Brees and Roethlisberger do so well, and then we can jump to the last three guys. When you're a QB, the first thing you need to learn is my mechanics and how to throw the ball. We're a professional QB still. Once you get that, and it doesn't go exactly like this, but these are kind of the stratospheres. After that, it's learn and master your system. Then it's master your system to the degree that you can now influence the defense. So think about audibles, think about motions and shifting and all the pre-snap stuff. Master your system so well that you can now use it as a weapon to manipulate the defense. Once you've done all that, and very few guys even get to that third stratosphere where they're defensive manipulators, once you do that, then it's can I use my mechanics to manipulate the defense? Do I understand my system so well? Does the game for me slow down mentally enough that I'm comfortable leading receivers and influencing safeties with my eyes and the pump fakes? Think of Roethlisberger and his pump fakes, the subtle mechanical twitches where I angle my body one way when I know I'm about to throw the other way. That takes a lot of poise to do that because it's counterintuitive, and you can only do it if you're comfortable with everything else. The best who's ever done it, in most coaches' opinions, about these mechanical influential movements, about just manipulating defenders physically, the best ever is Drew Brees. And that's part of the reason he's been so good as a 6-foot QB. You got to be able to manipulate safeties if you're going to be a small pocket passer. He's been that. And then I think Roethlisberger, who's a much, he's a staccato version of Brees, but he's also been exceptional at manipulating defenses with his physical movement.
Are we ready for the top three?
I am.
Number three, Carson Wentz. Number two, Aaron Rodgers. Number one, Tom Brady. I just wanted to ask, I wanted to ask you on Wentz. Year one to year two, obviously there was a huge leap. What difference did you see in what he did in year two as opposed to what he was as a rookie?
It was as simple as just a QB getting more comfortable. It was just experience building up. That's all it was. There was nothing. Now, they changed their approach a little bit. They were more of a deep drop back offense. In fact, I remember their first game against Washington in week one, their first several plays were balls thrown 50 yards downfield. They came out right away and established that that's the kind of offense we are, and they stayed with it. But they never lost their ability to do what they did in Wentz's rookie season, which is spread out and dink and dunk. And they did that to simplify the game for Wentz because he was a rookie. But they knew when they drafted Wentz, he's capable of running this full-fledged system. That's what he did at North Dakota State. That's what made him so attractive to teams. So this was the plan all along. They're just following down the plan. We're talking about a really special talent and a really cerebral football player, and this is what happens when you mix those things.
Aaron Rodgers, I'll say it was a little bit jarring watching Aaron Rodgers after he returned probably a little too early last year for the Panthers game. And, you know, there were some people saying when you break your collarbone on your throwing side, it's going to affect you mechanically. And he was not Aaron Rodgers, and that was a little bit sad. But I see no reason that he won't be Aaron Rodgers in 2018.
I hope he is. He is so fascinating because he's a lot like Russell Wilson. He doesn't play on schedule very often, even though he has all the reason to play on schedule. He can be a true pocket passer, and he can beat you on – he'll flip a switch and beat you the way Tom Brady beats you with pre-snap reads and rhythm throws. But more often than not, he goes off schedule on his own volition, and he can also beat you that way, even though it's not the right – quarterback play. He doesn't always make the right read, and he doesn't always throw with the right mechanics. And those two things are usually enough to keep a guy out of the NFL. This one's so talented that he's still not only in the NFL, but the best, perhaps, in the NFL.
Tom Brady, I don't know if there's really anything to talk about too deep with Tom Brady. It seems like the Patriots are going to move to more of a quick strike offense this year, as opposed to, you know, they did a little more deep stuff with Brandon Cooks in the lineup last year. I mean, I don't know. Does that make sense to you? Brady did get knocked around a little bit more than in the past early last season. But they were kind of trending more towards quick strike as the year went on last year anyway, right?
Yeah, they fell into that a little bit at times in the playoffs. The Tennessee game especially comes to mind. But for the most part, they were a deep drop back late in the down passing team, like what the Eagles are doing with Wentz, like what the Colts do with Andrew Luck. And Brady, who really has not been that kind of QB in his career, he's shown flashes of it, and he's never shown that he can't be that kind of QB. But not only did he handle it well, he had his best season. He was physically the best I've ever seen him. Now, I'm sure he would refute that and say, hey, you got to see what I do during the week to just get to play on Sunday anymore. Hey, I'm sure he doesn't feel the same way as he did in his mid-20s, although that TB12 stuff, maybe he'd argue that as well. But the point is, he's 40 years old, and he's playing better physically, not just mentally, physically than he ever did. He made more late-in-the-down contested throws from a muddy pocket than I've probably seen anyone ever make.
It's got to be those special pajamas that he wears. Are you a little bit disappointed? Are you a little bit disappointed that Cooks is not there? I mean, did you want to see them go with that, or is it kind of like, look, the guys, he's what, he just turned 41, or he's about to turn 41. I'm not sure what it is now. Let's make sure he doesn't take unnecessary hits.
I could understand the logic behind that, take unnecessary hits. They have to pay Brandon Cooks, too. The Rams just did pay him 5 years, $80 million. So the Patriots, and they could have waited till next year to pay him, and they could have franchised him. So they could have really kicked that can down the road, and by then maybe Brady's gone anyway, and they're rewriting the entire offense. So I understand why someone would say they should have kept Brandon Cooks, but I also understand why they would make the trade, because they – increase their draft picks. They built up their O-line and running game with those first-round picks that they used. And they still have James White. They've got Edelman back. Edelman was not there a year ago. That's part of the reason they also became less quick strike and more verticals. They lost their best short and intermediate route runner. They've got different personnel around Brady right now, and it's safer personnel. The ball will be – there's no way he'll take as many hits this year as he did last year. It's not going to be mathematically possible, because the ball is going to be out sooner. And I'm not going to fault any team for – thinking about the safety of its superstar 40-year-old quarterback, soon to be 41-year-old quarterback.
Yeah. All right. There it was, our top 10. Once again, mailbag coming up. We have the lightning-ish round, by the way, coming up in a second, but just wanted to give one more reminder. Mailbag show next week. Talkback at themmqb.com. Twitter, Facebook, send those questions. Lightning-ish round. Next 5 years,
I'm
going
to go very lightning on these. I'm going very – just so do not think I'm pouting or anything,
well,
they are lightning.
There are a lot of either-or questions. Next 5 years, Carson Wentz, Aaron Rodgers, or other?
Carson Wentz.
Yeah? I'll go Rodgers. Who is more likely – we're going to exclude Deshaun Watson here because we know him a little bit more. But who's more likely to be considered a top 15 QB from the 2017 draft class by the end of this season, Mitchell Trubisky or Patrick Mahomes?
I think Trubisky's the safer pick, and especially from perception, because Chicago has a good defense and they've now got some weapons around Trubisky. So I think the Bears as a team are more set up to have – surprising success than the Chiefs, who I know they have an explosive offense, but I see a lot of questions with their defense in Kansas City. So I think Trubisky's the safer pick, but if they do ascend to the top level, Mahomes has a much greater chance of ascending higher because he's the more dynamic talent. I'll take to answer the question. Yeah,
yes.
To answer the question, I will go. I don't think either of them is going to be top 15 by the end of this year quite yet. I'll go Mahomes then because of the wild talent factor.
I am also going Mahomes. I just want to point out that was a tremendous lightning-ish round answer gave. That was
after
perfect.
After promising I would be quicker.
True or false, a Kirk Cousins-led Vikings team is better than a Nick Foles-led Eagles team? Now, I was anticipating that we both agree that Carson Wentz-led Eagles would be the favorite in the NFC. My mind is still racing from the Falcons comment, but so we're taking, let's say Wentz, he just got married and he decides he wants to settle down. He has a Super Bowl ring and he's going to retire in the next couple weeks. So would you take Kirk Cousins-led Vikings or Nick Foles-led Eagles?
I take the Cousins-led Vikings, especially for factoring in the defenses.
I would too. Biggest breakout at quarterback for 2018?
Can we count the guys that everyone expects to break out? Like, is it a break? Let's say Garoppolo is what we expect. Did he break out or not? Because he's only played 5 games. I mean, 5 games is not very many. That's a third of a season. So
I'll give you Garoppolo because I think the expectations for Garoppolo are insanity at this point.
Okay. Well, and my other one, if it's not Garoppolo, and I hope it doesn't happen because it would involve luck not being out there, but I think Jacoby Brissett's a really good talent.
Yeah.
And if he's on the field and he's had a chance to learn the system for the full year, which he did not have last year, I could see him being a breakout player.
I'm saying Patrick Mahomes, but we did say that earlier. I want to ask you real quick before we wrap up the show, because I'd feel bad if I didn't bring his name up. But Marcus Mariota under Matt LaFleur, do you feel good about that? Do you feel bad about that? Do you feel nothing inside?
I don't feel nothing inside because I've been fascinated by Mariota, and I've spent a lot of time with LaFleur, especially talking quarterbacking mechanics. He's one of the best in the league at teaching that, and that's why he's there. Mariota needs reworked, and Mariota himself would tell you that. I feel a lot of something, but it all comes out neutral. I'm not overly optimistic for Mariota. I think he's in a good situation, and if he can't do it here, if he doesn't need to do it right away, he's learning a new offense while he's reworking his mechanics. That's a lot to ask of a guy. But over these next 2 years, if he doesn't improve significantly, I don't think he's an NFL starting quarterback in some people's minds. I am not overly optimistic, but I do believe in his skill set, and I believe in LaFleur. Yeah. So I guess I'm a little bit optimistic.
Yeah. Do you think a Goff under McVay scenario is likely or even possible in this case?
Not likely, because Tennessee really lacks speed on offense, and it's hard to. Goff was so good because he ran the designs that got explosive plays. We talked about the Falcons, when you run right on schedule and everything works pristinely, that's where you get explosive plays. Goff also had Todd Gurley, and they designed explosive plays for him. They don't have any of that stuff in Tennessee. They have a good backfield at best, and they have a lot of plotting wide receivers who are going to have to win in other ways besides just getting downfield. So, no, I don't expect a Goff turnaround. I'm surprised we didn't talk about Goff in this show either. But I think that's a lot to ask of Mariota in Tennessee.
Yeah, there's a lot of good, interesting quarterbacks in the show, and obviously we will be talking about them plenty in the weeks leading up to the season, or maybe someone has a mailbag question about them and they can send it in, those Goff questions, or any of these guys. We didn't talk Eli, we didn't talk Cousins really at all. I guess we talked Cousins a ton during the offseason, but...
Yeah, Cousins, I think he's gotten enough of the spotlight. You know, we'll wrap up on this. Someone actually, it was LaFleur, who said, you know, you have an advantage if you evaluate Cousins and don't know him personally. Because when you know him personally, he is so likable that it's hard. You worry that it skews your perception of him as a player. And I interviewed Cousins the other day. I forget for what now. But when he called me, I knew exactly what LaFleur meant, because Kirk Cousins was the nicest, most humble guy on the phone. Like, he's one of those that feel, he's so nice you feel bad about yourself. Like, well, I'll never be that. What kind of person am I? I'll never be that considerate. And I don't want to get to know Kirk Cousins till after he's done playing, because there are people in the league who genuinely think I can't evaluate him fairly because I like him too much.
Yeah. Chris Cooley had some good Kirk Cousins stories. If you ask the old Google machine to look those up for you, you can read all about that. But he's a nice fella. We'll talk about him coming up, but we did talk about him a ton. But that's a wrap. That's a wrap for the lightning-ish round. Another compact lightning-ish round is done, and our show is done for this week. Thanks, as always, to producer Shelby Royston, all the guys at Cadence 13 who make us sound so good. But really, thanks to you guys for listening to this episode of the MQB 10 Things podcast. If you missed any of the position ranking show, obviously this is usually our most listened to episode, but if you liked what you heard and want to listen to what we said about other positions, just go back in the feed. We covered everything. We told you everything you could possibly know about football over the last 10 weeks or so. Send those mailbag questions, talkback@themmqb.com, Twitter, Facebook, we're on there. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, and of course our show, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys with the mailbag next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.